The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Anna Kogal from the Triangle Radio Reading Service. For the next half hour, I shall be reading to you from the 2018 August issue of Glamour Magazine. Today's programming is underwritten with support from the Raleigh Kiwanis Foundation. They can be reached by kiwanisfoundation.org. Welcome back, everyone. 10 p.m. on August 23rd, Thursday evening. Heading back to school, are you? Maybe. Maybe not. Still enjoying your summer? Well, I'm glad that you're back with me, and I am going to be starting off with, oh gosh, we have a whole bunch of articles from the Glamour magazine of August. Starting off with, "She helped me find humor in what makes me different." Yvonne Orji on Wanda Sykes. And there's a clip. It says, "Yeah, it's mutual. I'm a fan of hers," says Wanda Sykes, far right. And she's looking down at, straight into the camera with a white with black pinstripe suit on and her kind of afro-styled hair, big smile, warm eyes. "It means a lot when you see the younger generation appreciate what you're doing or what you've done." Wanda Sykes and I have had similar career trajectories. We're both from the D.C. area. She spent 5 years working as a contracting specialist for the NSA, and I got my master's in public health. Chris Rock gave us both our big chances. She was a writer on The Chris Rock Show. I opened for him on his Total Blackout tour last year. I started a comedy in 2006. I didn't even think it was a thing I could do. I have immigrant African parents. They would say in their Nigerian accents, "So you want to be a jester?" And I was like, "I don't want to be a court jester, Ma. I want to be a comedian." But what they meant was, do people make a living from this? Who are the black female comics who are successful? I remember Googling Wanda. Wanda has this certain cadence. She's like a stern auntie telling you about life. She has this one bit where she's talking about strip clubs in Florida. She's like, "Florida got so many strip clubs, they need to change their state flag to just a brass pole." And that's her humor. It's like setup, boom. Setup, boom. It doesn't take a long story to get there. And Wanda always has a point of view. She doesn't just let life happen. She's actively participating in it. And she's honest about it. She was married to a guy, and then she came out and got married to a woman. And now she can talk about being with a guy and then being with a girl. That's something very few people have the ability to pull humor from. As a performer, the thing you want the most is to be your authentic self. The fact that one of Wanda's comedy specials is called "I'm a Be Me" exemplifies the freedom we get to have as entertainers. I'm a clean comic, and when I was starting out, people were like, "Wouldn't this joke be funnier if you used the F word?" And I'm like, "Nope. I can do that. Not my brand. I can't do that. Not my brand." People would be like, "She's funny, but she's clean." There was always an asterisk to my talent, but I have a point of view. I'm Nigerian, and I'm American, and Christian. I'm waiting until I get married to have sex. I can speak to what that's like. Wanda helped me find that sweet spot. She helped me find humor in what makes me different. And that's Yvonne Orji, co-stars on Insecure, which returns to HBO this month. Wanda Sykes is on tour this fall. Okay, so now here's a similar story. At least it sounds like it's going to be similar. "She made it possible for me to do what I do." Rachel Bloom on Carol Burnett. As I sat back down at my seat in the Beverly Hilton after winning the Golden Globe for Best Performance by an Actress in a Television Series in 2016, I did what any millennial with a touch of ADHD would do. I checked my email. And the first thing that popped up was a message from Carol Burnett congratulating me. Not to sound ungrateful to the Hollywood Foreign Press, but that moment was my real Golden Globe. A month or two earlier, our mutual friend and my crazy ex-girlfriend co-star, Donna Lynn Champlin, told me Carol had asked for my email address. My response to her was, "Of course you can give Carol effing Burnett my email address. Give her my social security number and my liver, too." It was laughable that Carol felt she needed permission to email me, but when I finally got to meet her, I realized that, in a wonderful way, her fame still hasn't quite sunk in. Carol Burnett doesn't know that she's Carol Burnett. She was the first comedic actor whose essence I couldn't put into words. All I knew was that I couldn't stop watching her. When I performed my own rendition of Little Girls from Annie for my 8th grade talent show, the director told me not to copy her mannerisms. Not because I couldn't try, of course I did, but because she is a performer who is uncopyable. I read Carol's memoir one more time during an 8-hour bus ride in 2009 and was struck by the fact that, like me, she had trouble booking acting gigs during her first year living in New York City. She put together her own musical showcase with women in her boarding house and got discovered singing the original song, "I Made a Fool of Myself Over John Foster Dulles," which reminded me of a song about an older gentleman that I had written called F blank CK, me, Ray Bradbury. I had forgotten about it until I read Carol's book. That song became a must video, a music video, that got me my agent. I realize now that this is a lot about me. Forgive me, but that's the only way I know how to gush over an icon who has done as much for female comics as she has. If Carol hadn't ignored the head of CBS when he said that the variety was a man's game in the 60s, she wouldn't have made it possible for me and all of my female creator performers in TV to do what we do. She may not ever know that she's Carol Burnett, but at least now she knows how much I love her. Rachel Bloom is the co-creator and star of CW's Crazy Ex-Girlfriend. Watch Carol Burnett now in Netflix's A Little Help with Carol Burnett. Okay, well, we're going to continue on the silver screen thing that we're on right now. Person of interest, Sharon Horgan, is the realest mother on TV by Justine Harmon. Before she was one of comedy's most cult-loved voices, Sharon Horgan was adrift. After moving to London from a turkey farm in rural Ireland, she waited tables, toiled away at an office job, and even sold bongs to stoners. "A lot of trying and failing," she recalls of her 20s. "I basically did everything I could possibly do to avoid starting my actual, genuine career." Then, at 35, she and a longtime friend and fellow lackey, Dennis Kelly, wrote a sitcom all about their professional shortcomings. The raunchy Pulling, which aired on the BBC from 2006 to 2009, was a success and a wake-up call. With Pulling, I found out that writing about something tragic and sad can be fully hilarious if you look at it from a slightly different angle, she says. I haven't wanted to write in a different way since. Sure, she is the mother dragon behind foul-mouthed, tragic comedies like Divorce and Motherland, but it's Catastrophe, the Amazon show she co-created and stars in, that elevated her to the comedic pantheon. She earned a Best Writing Emmy nomination for the show and a BAFTA nod for her as Sharon Morris, an Irish woman in London who gets pregnant after a week-long hookup with American Rob Norris, Rob Delaney, and dives headfirst into an unlikely relationship. The story is based on Horgan's own life. 6 months after meeting British entrepreneur Jeremy Rainbird, she found out she was expecting. The couple is now married with two daughters. The plot may sound like the setup for a schmaltzy rom-com, but Catastrophe approaches everything from alcoholism and infidelity to motherhood with uproarious frankness. In season two, for example, Sharon is desperate to return to work after her second child is born. To be honest, I didn't realize how much I love teaching until I had to be around my own kids 24 hours a day, she tells a stunned job interviewer before admitting that it's just hard to know how to do things, and bursting into tears. Sharon's not afraid to admit when she's lonely or depressed or any of those things you feel when you're a mother, Horgan, now 48, says. She can be sweet and loving and scared and needy. And equally, she can have balls of steel. I don't know if that's more common for Irish women, but I've got two personalities inside of me at all times. Directness, friends confirm, is a Horgan trademark. She's quite straightforward, Kelly says. I don't think she analyzes herself or what she's doing, and I don't think she wants to. Partly because Sharon doesn't want to be a wanker, says Delaney. When we're writing, we're like two technicians in lab coats with the exact same goal of producing the best possible scripts. She's taught me a lot about stories that make ironclad sense. Despite the series' brisk pace, each season is composed of 6 24-minute episodes. The emotional center always holds. At the end of the last season, Sharon is grappling with her dad's recent death. She's not grieving properly. She's not feeling the things she thinks she should be feeling. Horgan says, one of the mums from my daughter's school came up to me on the playground and said, I have those same feelings. They made me feel awful. And after watching, I feel a little less awful. That's been our yardstick, to say things that maybe seem a bit gross or terrible, and then be pleasantly surprised that other people feel them too. Horgan's gift is finding the humanity in the humor. When I look at Sharon's work, I don't think of it as deliberately dark, Kelly says. I think she's just being honest about the world as she sees it. And for her, the funniest moments don't require a clever pun or a zany coincidence. It has to make us laugh. If we're not laughing several times per page, we're not doing it. But it doesn't have to be a ridiculous sort of gag either. It can be something so true it's funny, she says. We like there to be two good storylines running solidly through the beginning, middle, and end. We don't like to just have a series of events. We like SH-blank-T to happen. All right, and now we're going to continue on with hashtag live or live. Personal history. How I got my first laugh. Every comedian remembers her first. The first time she noticed an opening in the conversation, queued up the perfect zinger, and slayed. A laugh is so undeniable, says Glow star Betty Gilpin. See her in Glow with it. It's a surge of love that shoots through you, and you get addicted to that feeling. We asked some of our favorite funny women to revisit their first ha-ha-ha-ha moment. And For even more first laughs, check out glamour.com/first-laugh. And this is by Samantha Leach. Aparna Nansherla channeled Bollywood. My cousin's sister and I made a lo-fi Bollywood movie called Dil Kebab, because dil means heart, and a kebab is on a skewer. I think we were trying to take down love. We were mostly concerned with needing one dance number, a costume change, and a product placement. Nansherla stars in Comedy Central's Corporate. Kathy Griffin helped the shy kid. There was a boy in my class the kids were hard on. I remember shielding him by making fun of the others. That's when I realized laughter can get you out of a effing jam. Laughter can be a way that you can respond to a bully without punching them. I honed some of my BITCH skills at Catholic school. Griffin is on tour with Kathy Griffin. Laugh your head off. Ellie Wong did butt stuff. I grew up going to a Chinatown youth group, and in sixth grade, we played telephone, but with skits. The first person acted out washing an elephant. When I was up, I ran a sponge around what I later realized was the butt area. People were laughing so hard that I kept milking it by acting like I was about to stop, but then I'd just keep going. It all started with the butt. Now we hear. Wong is the star of Ali Wong, Hard Knock Wife on Netflix. Natasha Rothwell, Let It Rip. When I was 13, I spent my allowance on a whoopee cushion. One day my mom had her church friends over and was like, "Okay, kids, go outside." So I blew up the cushion, put it in my jacket, and gave my mom a hug. And she just lost it because it was funny. I remember thinking, wow, humor can even take down a parent. Rothwell produces, writes, and stars in Insecure on HBO. Bridget Everett stole the show. I played Sister Bertha in The Sound of Music. I was pissed I didn't get to play the Mother Superior, but I made the most of it. During this somber part, I made faces like, "What's that smell?" or "This is what I owe in taxes?" I was the star, and I'm not gonna lie. There was something sexy about it. Everett co-stars in the upcoming Camping on HBO. All right, and now Late Night New Life. Much has been made of the political tenor dominating the land of late night talk shows these days, and for good reason. In addition to cracking jokes, hosts are now expected to take a hard stance on the day's divisive headlines. Unfortunately, with a few notable exceptions, the talent fronting late night is still white, still male. Among the top late night shows we looked at, rarely are more than 30% of the writers women. Only about 11% are people of color. This means every whistle-blowing monologue or feminist sketch that makes it to air is more than just comedy. It's a shot across the bow from the underrepresented. To find out what it's really like in the late-night trenches, Glamour gathered top female writers from 6 shows to talk about how they check the guys, the highs and lows of being comedy's secret weapons, and why, if we want our girls to be funny, we have to get to them early. Glamour. Let's get right to it. Regarding diversity in the writers' room, how are today's shows doing? Jasmine Pierce, staff writer, The Tonight Show, starring Jimmy Fallon. I mean, we've made a ton of progress, even in the last year or so, regarding diverse rooms and diverse shows. But there is still a long way to go. Kat Radley, staff writer, The Daily Show with Trevor Noah. I would say it's still, what, 20 to 25% for women in the room? Does anyone have a 50-50 writer's room? Pia Glenn, staff writer, The Opposition with Jordan Klepper. She raises her hand. Boom! Yes, we're the newest of the bunch, so there might be a correlation. But when we go one tier above to the decision makers, we are right back at largely white men. Melinda Taub, head writer, Full Frontal with Samantha Bee. Tina Fey said something about how some shows view women like cappuccino makers, like, we have one, what would we do with another? And while that's still an issue, not just with women, but also with other marginalized groups, I think shows are realizing that even if you don't want to equalize rooms out of the goodness of your heart, it makes your show better. Ariel Dumas, writer and digital content producer, The Late Show with Stephen Colbert. We just hired our fourth female writer, which is really exciting. But that's more exciting for me. But what's more exciting for me is that people aren't saying women in comedy so much anymore. I never think about being a woman in comedy. I'm just in comedy. Jasmine, yeah, I'm not a comedian. I'm just a comedian. So comedian, E-N-N-E. Ariel, I mean, do we sit around wanting to know what it's like to be a man in comedy? Kat, I definitely feel like I know. And they all laugh. While there is work to be done, everyone thinks that means actively going out and finding more women to write for you. Which is one way to do it, sure, but it's also systemic because fewer women are trying to be comedians and have to start, sorry, not and, you have to start with the five-year-olds. Tell them they're funny. Encourage them to express their comedy because it's not occurring to so many until they're 25 or 30 that they can do comedy. Molly McNeary, co-head writer, Jimmy Kimmel Live. Most of the application packets that are coming into any show are still white men, and it's our job to reach out to women. We have to get into different communities, to people who might not think they can do our job because they never saw someone that looked like them doing it. Twitter has helped a lot. Yes, says Jasmine, it's a great tool for encouraging young writers. I used to write for Reductress, and now I make an intentional effort to support their new good writers. I always tweet a writer's stuff and then message her and tell her, you are so good. Keep going. We have to be active about it. Otherwise, it's so scary. Do you have to actively navigate being the gender minority? And that's a question from Glamour. Kat. It's really just about working together. For us, it's never been like the men write the man stuff and the women write the women stuff. Everyone can and does do everything. Jasmine, it's the same for us. Ariel, us too. If I want to pitch a thing about IUDs, a super female woman-y woman story, I don't feel like I am the one that has to write it. The guys can write that too. Kat, but we do have to be conscious of checking in. I noticed the other day in the rehearsal script someone had written Congressman. I texted our head writer. We need to change it to Member of Congress or Congress People. He changed it immediately. Ariel, I think that's what really helped by having women in the room. Our writers are also feminist and anti-racist, but everyone has the ability to say something if they need to. Melinda, you have to be as honest as you can with your staff. I think that helps me and helps all of us to find the most dangerous, true version of what we want to say, even if it means texting Sam in the middle of the night, which, for her is like 9 p.m. when you're having feelings. Pia, in our room, I think there is a real validity to everyone's lived experience being different. I don't ever blame anyone for things they might not know or have not been exposed to. It's what you do once you've been made aware that matters more. I think about the sexual assault stories that came up and how we talk about it in the room. There's a visceral anger that comes up when the women speak about it, and the guys know to shut up and take it in. Glamour. How can writing for a host give agency to your perspective? Melinda, it's so different when it's women dominated from the top. I didn't realize how hard I was fighting to write in other people's voices until I got to Sam, and I was like, oh, I can just be me. Pia, Jordan absolutely amplifies my voice in terms of point of view, because I am such an advocate for black female representation, and in the comedy world, make sad trumpet noise. So much of the time, even as filtered through the extremely white man, I can take credit for our angle on Trump's America or dog whistles about racism. It might not sound like my voice coming out of his mouth, but it definitely is. Molly, I have a unique situation in that the host of my show is also my husband, so he's uniquely qualified to amplify my voice as a comedian and writer. Like when our son went through his heart condition, his open heart surgeries, Jimmy allowed me to tell a story that I never could have. I was feeling those same things but didn't have the strength to go on national television and talk about it. I would have made Jimmy's crying look like nothing. Kat, Trevor always asks questions, like with the Harvey and Me Too stuff. He'd ask if the approach was right, if we wanted to lead the discussion. Glamour, was there a time when you had to say to a male writer, no way, that won't fly? Molly, I remember when Hillary was coming on a year ago. People were still making pantsuit jokes. I was like, what the F are you doing? You're minimizing this woman to her clothes? We'd never talk about a man's outfit. Everyone heard me, and they did cut it. But there is learning to be had. These men don't know, you know? So it's our responsibility to teach them. In the same way, I would hope that we'd all be open to learning about things that might offend straight white guys. Melinda, funny. I don't care about that. Pia, I'm totally fine offending them. Well, that's our show for today. We hope you've enjoyed Teen Magazines. I'm Aniko Gala, reading for the Triangle Radio Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. The broadcast can be readily available as a podcast after the broadcast at our website, triangleradioreadingservice.org. Today's programming is underwritten with support from the Raleigh Kiwanis Foundation. They can be reached at kiwanisfoundation.org. So long until next time. If you have any comments or questions, please call 919-832-5138.